How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvers and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is January 4th, 2011, here at Figure 4 Online.
January 4th, that means Tokyo Dome.
That's right, the Tokyo Dome show is starting, actually,
right,
I guess,
around now.
Literally any time now. So, maybe
it's starting right around now.
So we have some updates as we do the show here, but several TNA talents on the show. Traditionally the biggest show of the year in Japan, as far as pro wrestling is concerned. So if we get results, we'll give them to you here on the show, and if not, I'm sure we'll have stuff up on the front page tomorrow. But lots of news to talk about, and we're going to kick it off today. Chael Sonnen. I got to say this. I got a text earlier tonight before I heard what this story was, and it just read, Chael Sonnen going to federal prison, which is probably jumping the gun quite a bit there. But when I first read it, I thought, what the hell happened? Does this have something to do with him claiming he talked to Keith Kaiser and he didn't? Did they charge him with perjury or something?
Actually, he could. They could be the next thing in front of him.
That was my immediate thought. But as it turned out, a count of money laundering. He faces a maximum 20 years in prison, $500,000 fine. But according to at least one article I read, they are recommending 2 years of probation.
So the deal is that he's turning state's evidence against people who they think were more involved. Apparently, there was a let me actually get my notes on that. But there was a company, pushed the wrong button. But Lighthouse Financial Group of Vancouver, Washington, that had been involved, I guess, in some of this stuff. And Chael was involved with them and, I guess, pled guilty to writing up a report claiming that this house that he was selling needed $69,000 worth of repairs for plumbing, and sent the letter to the mortgage company, Decision One Mortgage Company, that's actually out of business now. And so they sent the $69,000 to the plumbing company, which is owned by Chael Sonnen's mother, who actually did know plumbing. And the plumbing company kicked back $65,000 to the people who were, I guess, buying the house, and that way they bought the house and got the $65,000. And so those people are actually the ones that the government's really after, and Sonnen turned on them. So Sonnen's not probably, he's most likely getting a very, getting kind of a slap on the wrists. But he's had to give up his he's going to have to give up his real estate license.
And he was talking about this, actually, he didn't give any details, but several months back when he talked about an issue with the federal government that he was in the midst
during
of.
The Anderson Silva buildup, he had, well, he mentioned it in passing when he withdrew from the race for House of Representatives in Oregon.
He said if it went poorly, he may not be able to run until 2011.
Right. And it went poorly.
I wonder if he's going to run again.
I can't imagine.
I can.
I can't imagine. With everything, there's no way.
This guy, he'll do anything.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess it's possible, but I don't see it. I don't know, he's scheduled to be facing Yoshihiro Akiyama on the Newark show on March 19th. And right now, I guess the best answer is that there is no answer on whether that fight is going to take place or not, or what UFC is going to do regarding this news. So everything's kind of, I guess, up in the air on that.
Very interesting in that, one guy is, obviously two different charges, but, in the Jeff Hardy case, it's like, the dude's still champion right now. He may not be when he is sentenced. They could take the title off him at the pay-per-view or on TV or something like that, but, he's still the champion. And meanwhile, this whole thing with Chael, I would guess that UFC has no idea what they're going to do about this situation, and it's not just, initially it doesn't look like they're just going to ignore it. There's going to be discussions about what to do.
Yeah. Well, it's a 2006 charge, which this is something that happened before he was even in UFC. I don't know how that plays into it.
It's just kind of a deal, though, where, it's like he's got this, And then he's got the whole deal with the California Commission, and obviously he said some things that
he's going to have a deal with the Nevada Commission too.
Yep, he's going to have to deal with the Nevada Commission. Right now he's not licensed, and he's going to have to I guess explain himself before they even consider licensing him. He said some things at the trial that UFC was not happy with. So it's like, you know, it kind of gets to the point where, is this man worth all of this trouble?
Well, I mean, they don't need him. They don't need anyone. They don't need anyone. It's you know, I don't know. I don't know the situation. I mean, you know, the UFC normally, like, if a guy gets licensed, they'll let him fight. But it's a felony. It's not a drug felony, although he's got the drug thing. I don't know. If the government doesn't put him in jail, should he be fired? I mean, put it this way: I would never want him running for office. But as far as fighting in UFC, that's a different issue. I don't know. I can't say for sure if I would fire him over this. I would certainly think about it, though. And I would certainly strongly think about it. And if there was, I don't know, it may be the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, like after the steroid thing, you know, I know that there were some people who thought that they should fire him over that. And to me, I would not have made that call to fire him over that. After this, after that hearing, I wouldn't have been so quick to bring him back. But, you know, it's a tough one. It's certainly on the border. It's on the border. That would be for sure.
I want to mention this before we get into the Raw report. I watched the last four matches on the Dream Show before I watched Raw. Mm-hmm. And I had watched all the way up to the Sakuraba fight, which, I mean, granted, if nothing else, it was quite the spectacle. And
Sakuraba? Yeah.
Okay. That was a hell of a spectacle. But when I watched, like, the last four fights, I knew this really watching the show, and I've known this for a while, but there was just something about watching the last four fights and the Bibiano Fernandez main event. It was just kind of like, man, it's really sad how this has all turned out.
Well, I mean, I thought it's just sad because on the show, when they showed those clips at the beginning of the show, you know, of like the 10-year highlights and things like that, and it was so hot, and then you see the show, and it's clearly not. I mean, it wasn't a terrible show. There were definitely moments to it. When there's 14 fights, you know, there were some good ones. There were no great fights on the show, but the atmosphere. I mean, the atmosphere was of something that was really big. That's just down the, you know, just not popular anymore. That's
yes.
The only way to put it. And yeah, it was. I felt when it was over that it was just kind of sad.
Yeah, that's the exact feeling that I had when that show ended. It was just like, wow, you look back at, I mean, I watched almost every Pride event and, you know, the glory days of MMA in Japan. And then, you know, these two guys are out there having a main event for a title and you know.
It was. I'll tell you what, the one thing about that, though, that was a really bad, I was shocked from day one that they put that match on last and that they were billing that match as the main event.
Yeah, that's the last thing you remember on the show. And you end up really sad the way things have panned out.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like it was a terrible fight, and their first fight was great, and their first fight was the main event of a show in, you know, in October, I think it was October of 2009, and it was a great main event, but on this show, for whatever reason, you know, especially when you're going with the general public and everything like that.
That's the whole thing.
You got those two guys, it just should not have been the main event, and I mean, title match or no title match, and title change, you know, and it was Japanese winning a championship. You know, in a fight that the Japanese fighter had a very good shot at winning and did, but it just, you know, it wasn't. They're not famous enough.
I mean, when you talk about like the Bob Sapp fight, the 55 million viewers that tuned in.
Bob Sapp and Akebono in 2003.
Yeah, there are not 55 million hardcore fans in Japan. That's a gigantic number of non fans or very casual fans.
It's everyone in the freaking country.
Half of them.
It's literally almost half
of the people in the entire country.
127 million people.
Yeah, and you're not getting anywhere. I don't want to say a half the country. You're not getting like a fifth of the country or anything like that to tune in for two guys that people don't know having a good fight. It's just, it really hit me like, wow, this is just like, I don't even know. I mean, I, you know, I'm sure there's been a lot of discussion, obviously, about whether K1 is going to last the year, and there are a lot of discussions about that, and whether if they do, there's going to be.
Well, they're going to need some new money, and they're going to need some sort of a strategy, because business in Japan, I don't know where it's I don't know where there's any profits in Japan right now, and expanding overseas. Did they have the guys where you can go overseas and you know, like, you need certain personalities and you need certain type of television, and I don't think they have it. And I guess, you know, you can, with new money, you can maybe do something, but I just don't, they don't have enough stars. And, like, for Japan, the stars that they had, you know, most of the key ones lost, and they weren't that big of stars anyway. I mean, Sakuraba, in a sense, is the biggest star, but he hasn't been able to carry a company for years and shouldn't even be fighting. And Aoki never got over to the mainstream. You know, I mean, he was very popular in the building, but he's not a mainstream star yet. But he's certainly a bigger star than Hiroyuki Takaya. You know, and I don't know, I'm not saying that, you know, it was a show with a lot of decent matches, but it was a show that didn't have the blockbuster main event. And, you know, a New Year's Eve show in Japan, I mean, you got to appeal to everyone, and they didn't, you know, and the rating was terrible. I mean, they ended up doing a 9.2, actually.
Oh, really?
9.8 that was just the prime time. They did 9.8 for the, they broke it up into like two segments, and the 9.8 would have been like the main events, but the show as a whole did a 9.2.
Yee.
And, you know, they edited a lot of the stuff. Sakuraba's fight didn't air on television because of, you know, it was not considered suitable for the mass audience. And, you know, the biggest fight to the public was Ishii and Jerome LeBanner, but Ishii doesn't have it. And it was painful watching Ishii and Izumi, who they, you know, wanted to push as the new stars, and just see, like, them not get over, even though both won, you know, and both won over big names, you know, Izumi won over Manoa Man, and Ishii won over Jerome LeBanner. But, you know, it's not about, especially in Japan, it's a different world. It's not about winning and losing. It's about getting over, and they didn't get over.
Let's talk about Raw. This show, to me, the defining thing about this show was that John Cena wasn't on it at all. And
it was still a good show.
Yeah, but I was just astounded that, you know, they couldn't even keep him off a single show when he was fired. And then when he gets reinstated, all of a sudden he misses an entire show. And
well, it's because obviously he can't be there. The thing that I found, there were a couple of really interesting things about the show, but one of them was when they said John Cena might be on next week's show. To me, it was like, okay, obviously he's hurt. And I think that they are hoping he'll be on the show, but by saying might, that's kind of like hedging their bets in case he can't be. So, but they're afraid. You know, they're afraid to do a show without him. I mean, they made it. I almost wonder if they made that announcement at the beginning of the show that he wasn't going to be there to make people think, aha, he's going to be there. But he really wasn't there.
Sure.
And then, you know, next week they tell you, you know, he might be back. It's like they are, I don't know. You know, they, they acknowledge the injury.
Yeah.
I mean, WWE is so hilarious about certain things. And one of them was, he was injured in Pennsylvania because Vince decreed that Wilkes-Barre is not a city that can be mentioned on national television. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
We can't admit that we toured a Wilkes-Barre on a national show.
Yeah. That's what they did. They came out and they said he's not there. He was injured in, quote, a one-on-one match with Wade Barrett in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So they could have been brawling in a field or in a pine barren, for all we know.
Yeah.
And he said that...
actually, they were in a cage.
Well, that's true, actually. He didn't mention that, though, of course. But he did say he was injured. Later, they acknowledged it was from the wasteland. And there you go. I was just fascinated because... later it made sense. But when he first made this announcement, I was like, okay, I'm all for acknowledging things that happen on house shows, because you want to get people to show up. And if you tell them that something important happened on a house show, then maybe when the house show comes to town, they'll think, okay, well, this is something to go to. But when at the beginning of the show, he's mentioning that Cena is wrestling Wade Barrett in Pennsylvania, I was just like, Wade Barrett hasn't even been around. You know what I mean?
Oh, he was around.
He ended up being around, so it worked out in the end. But when he first mentioned that, I was thinking, Wade Barrett better be on the show, or this is going to be just weird. But yeah, he was there, so there you go. We had Miz and Morrison for the title, Falls Count Anywhere, in the opener, which was an interesting choice of placement. They had a hell of a match.
I think they felt that because, you know, they had to get that out of the way so they could start building up the match on who's going to face Miz.
Well, they got it out of the way, all right. It was a great Falls Count Anywhere match for television. They brawled all over the place. There was a dive off a giant WWE statue-type deal at the ramp. They did the big backdrop onto the guardrail out in the crowd. Morrison made a big comeback. Miz kicked out of the Starship Pain. And then at the finish, they ended up outside, and Morrison set up a table on the ground. And he did the Starship Pain off the turnbuckle by the post, crashed the table on the ground. In a million years, I never would have done that, but Morrison does not care about his future, apparently. And bad landing. They immediately did the skull-crushing finale finish, and match of the year. It's only 3 days in, but so far, and
it was an excellent match.
Yep, bad news.
More because of Morrison and Miz. Although, you know, Miz did a good job too.
I will say that Morrison, I mean, I think he knew this was like a super important match for him because he was working his ass off, and he was just drenched in sweat by the finish.
Oh,
and crazy.
I mean, he did a shining wizard on
Riley.
On Alex Riley, who was like sitting on the barricade.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a flying shining wizard.
Yeah.
And I mean, and hit it perfectly too.
Yep.
I mean, they showed the replay of it. It was like, wow, that was like really, that was a hard move to do that perfect.
And he did it. He pulled out all the stops here.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's kind of too bad in a sense because it's like this guy had, you know, he had a really great match with Sheamus on the pay-per-view. He had a great match here. But his role was still to be in the exact same spot he was, and they didn't, you know, they didn't have faith in him to be on. Well, I think they don't have faith to do a pay per view without Orton or Cena in a title match. It's just they won't do it.
That's the whole deal. Is you put those guys in the Royal Rumble. I
think that they just feel that they have a streak of, you know, like 2.5 years or whatever it is, where every single show Cena or Orton is in a title match, and I think that they want to make sure that the streak lasts forever.
I was very disappointed when, near the end of the show, they're setting up the cage match, and they just cut to Randy Orton's clenching jaw, and he did his usual promo, said he wasn't going to be a nice guy anymore, and I just thought, God, it's you again. And I got nothing against the guy, but, you know, for the last couple of weeks, we'd had something really different on Raw, where Miz, he had the little deal with Lawler, which obviously wasn't going to go that far, because it's Lawler, but it was still really great for what it was. And then you had Morrison in the mix, and you had all these things, and then suddenly it's 2011, it's time to build the Rumble, and so Lawler's gone, he's not even on the show, because Miz killed him last week. They blow off the Morrison thing in the very first segment, and it's back to the same thing we see all the time. And I just thought, it would have been nice for once, just on Royal Rumble, where it doesn't matter, to just have somebody else get a pay-per-view title shot. But what can you do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought it was really obvious when they did that six-man tag with Lawler, Morrison, and Orton during this period where Morrison was supposed to be the top contender, and it was just so obvious watching that match that Morrison was the number three guy on that team, and Orton was clearly the star of the team. And I was thinking, like, wait a minute, isn't Morrison the one getting the title shot? And that's when I kind of realized that, well, they're really building to Orton getting the title shot. Morrison's just, you know.
Well, I kind of, it was stupid in hindsight, but at the time I kind of overlooked it because they were really building up that Orton was going to be on SmackDown the next day. And so I thought, okay, well, he's on SmackDown the next day in a big match.
Yeah,
so
he was on SmackDown with this very match.
Sure.
And you know, pretty much winning the match. I think it was a DQ finish or something, wasn't it?
I believe Riley ran in or something.
Yeah, with Riley, and then, you know, so I mean, they always book Orton, you know, Orton strong like a superstar. They're very protective of him. I thought that the other thing that I thought, especially when Michael Cole, and granted he's, you know, always, you know, the Miz's announcer, but I just thought that the verbiage that Michael Cole used, it didn't seem natural, which usually means it's being fed. and that means that, you know, it's being fed by Vince, that they were there. You know, there's been some, I don't know what the, you know, Miz himself has even done interviews saying that people don't take him seriously as champion. You know, that they're not taking him seriously yet, and he has to prove, you know, to take him seriously. And, you know, they sometimes will book champions very weak, and then they don't come off well as champions, like Swagger was a perfect example of this. They obviously have plans for Miz. You know, I'm guessing he's going to, the last I heard, you know, and I would think that this is how it would turn out, is that he is going to be in, you know, one of the title matches at WrestleMania, so he's got to be kept strong. And I think they have this feeling, well, he lost on a count to Lawler, and he hasn't been booked strong, so we need to sacrifice someone to get Miz over. And I think that this whole match was designed to give Miz a clean win in a world championship match and just get him over. And, you know, Morrison's job was to, you know, put him over strong, which he did, skull-crushing finale on the floor. But in the process, Morrison, I think, you know, got that thing where, you know, if you look really, really good, you know, while losing, you know, you help yourself. And in a sense, he probably did to the fans. I don't know that he's passed the test of the office. You know, we'll have to wait and see. You know, it's just so hard for a babyface, you know, especially a heel to a degree, but a babyface even more, to be elevated past that certain level. You know, it's, and, you know, they'll pick something, whether it's, you know, that he's weak on interviews or something. You know, even if they get over, which we've seen many, many times, where a guy in his position will get over real big, and they still don't pull the trigger. The only one where they ever pulled the trigger, what I would say big, or one of the only ones, was Hardy, and that was because it was so ridiculously big that they would have been fools not to. Whereas Morrison, I mean, it's, you know, the people aren't so behind him where you go, oh, you've got to push him. Everyone wants him being pushed. The people are kind of sitting there with the same attitude of like, well, we'll wait and see. You know, we'll wait and see. We don't trust this one. But they were into the match.
Yes.
But they, you know, you could see they didn't see, you know, Morrison as that level of a superstar either.
They announced after all of the weeks of having Lawler as a contender and Morrison and Orton that tonight there was going to be a cage match with the winner becoming the number one contender. So there you go. We had a fellow named Scott who apparently was on...
Scott Sanford. He's been around for... He's been with the company for a long time.
Superstars. He's done the pre-shows on...
I've seen him doing him and the other guy. What's the other guy's name? I forget now. That shows how memorable they are, but the two talking heads that do the pre-show.
Yeah. He interviewed Miz, who talked about how awesome he was, and I guess he was rallying for Best Technical Wrestler and Best Brawler in the Observer Awards.
And most charismatic. And best on interviews.
And I don't expect any... Well, interviews is a possibility, I guess, but I don't know about
best... He'll do well in best on interviews.
Riley was there, by the way, so the Shining Wizard that had him carted out by doctors and such, he was fine a half a segment later. Tough guy. He should at least not be on the show the rest of the night. I know.
Yeah.
Especially since
he was completely not needed in that segment anyway.
No. Then we had a really interesting segment. First, they recapped the Melina heel turn, and then the Melina deal last week with Beth. Or maybe it was Natalia.
No, it was Natalia.
So they have a match. It's Melina Maurice and Alicia Fox against Brie Bella, Eve, and Natalia. They had all the girls work for once, which actually made the match better because nobody was in the ring for any length of time. And
Wasn't that good?
Then at the end...
I didn't think it was that good.
It wasn't that good, but it was better than some of the terrible matches they've had.
Oh, God, you're grading on a curve now. I mean, I thought it was a not good match.
I learned that from Impact. So Natalia laid out Melina and then Eve pinned her, so...
Yeah, well, then Eve pinned her clean with a neck breaker. That was, you know, as soon as I saw that, it was like, that's obviously for the Twitter thing.
Get off Twitter, people.
It's not so much get off Twitter. Okay, they need to have a symposium on how to deal with media, like UFC does, where they bring all the talent in and they just kind of teach them the facts of life. And, I mean, you would think some of them should be, you would think that some of them, you know, would be have enough common sense, but they don't. And it's like, do not talk about your relationships on Twitter. You're not a human being in WWE. You are a larger than life personality, and you can say funny things, and you can, you know, do that. But don't say anything like you're frustrated with your push. Don't do that because it's just never going to help you. Don't praise the opposition promotion, because that's not going to help you. Just, and again, like, you know, if you break up with a relationship, unless it's a television relationship, don't acknowledge it, because they want you to be your television personality. They don't want you to be your real person. And some of them have, you know, problems with that.
I don't know how this is so hard to figure out.
Which I can kind of understand, because most people on Twitter are actually being themselves, as opposed to being some, you know, if you're like an actor on Twitter, you don't play your freaking personality on the in your movie, whereas these wrestlers are supposed to play their personality, and I think it's kind of confusing to some of them, and some of them just, you know, I think some of them just have issues. I mean, in the sense that they want sympathy, or they're just sad, and they can't keep it to themselves, and Twitter's a vehicle, and unfortunately the whole world sees it, and so does management.
Santino and Kozlov face the Usos. This was also strange.
Okay, you're going to have to explain this one to me.
I
watched this, and when it was over, all I could think of is, I have no clue what this was supposed to be.
Besides
the Kozlov spot, that was funny.
God. First off, the Usos didn't get an entrance, which usually means a short nothing match. So then they had a match, and they wrestled for a while, and then there was a big comeback by Santino, and it broke down in a four-way, and they did the big spot where Kozlov had to be low-bridged. No,
he was supposed to. They were supposed to go down the ropes. He was supposed to go over the top.
Sure.
And the man could not go over the top. He tried.
Now, usually when you try and low-bridge a guy or clothesline him over the top or whatever it is, and he doesn't get over the first time, usually he'll either get over the second time or he'll just roll under the ropes. Not Kozlov. He tried this three times. Three times it took this giant Russian to get over the top rope to the floor. The announcers were laughing. Oh, my God. So Santino was left in the ring after his fool partner couldn't get over the top rope and went for the Cobra, took a Samoan drop, got pinned. So
I was stunned.
One would immediately think, okay, well, the Usos are being set up for a tag title shot. Well,
I would think.
After the match, the good guys and Tamina got in the ring, and they not only beat up the heels, but Tamina gave one of them the Cobra, which he took a bump for, and they were left looking like complete imbeciles. So
why did they beat the tag team champions?
Listen, if they're going to beat the tag champs to get a title match next week, that's fine. But if you're going to do that,
then you didn't do what you didn't do the post match thing with the Cobra.
You do not humiliate them afterwards.
This, the whole thing made no sense at all. It's like, you could do one thing, you can do the other, but you did two things that just completely contradicted each other.
Yeah, that was a baffling segment right there. Just
and terrible.
Yeah, baffling and terrible.
I mean, bad booking and bad work.
Yeah, horrible segment. So they showed a screen cap of the New York Times saying Tough Enough was returning.
You know what's funny about that is it was a gimmick New York Times.
A mock-up?
I mean, that article was in the New York Times, but
it wasn't a full-page article with a giant headline. Are you kidding me?
No, and it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like the typeface in that article was three times the size of the other articles.
Wow.
So they gimmick. But anyway, Tough Enough's coming back, and on April the 4th, the Monday after WrestleMania at 11 o'clock, although the regular time slot's going to be 8 o'clock, which to me, I'd go with 11. 11's a lot less pressure than 8. 8 on the USA Network, I mean, those...
It will be forgotten 50% of the time by 50% of the people.
I don't know about that, but the point is that you know, you're in a situation where you got a show that usually is doing about a 3, sometimes as high as a 3.5. Well, not anymore, but, I mean, it had been. But it's doing solid 3s, and I don't see Tough Enough going in that time slot doing 3s.
I predict within 3 weeks it's back at 11 p.m.,
Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, they got a 10-week run, and you know, they want experienced wrestlers. They're not going to be novices. They've been scouting, but they've been sending letters to indies and to modeling agencies. You know, telling them to send people. I mean, it's not going to be. They're doing the casting in a couple weeks, and I guess they probably start the filming in I think just a few more weeks, maybe February or something. Better start pretty soon if they're going to be getting that show on the air in April because they need to have the season done so they know how to, you know, how to start it before and get everything done for those episodes.
Then we had Punk come out for a promo, and he talked about how Cena was going to be there and talked about how he represented hustle, loyalty, and respect, unlike John Cena. Talked about how he was the new leader of Nexus. They had begged him to be their leader. And this is when we got the return of Wade Barrett. And they got into a big argument about who the leader was, and Nexus ended up coming out. And basically, the GM dinged, and this was when they decided to alert us that the cage match was going to be either Barrett or Punk versus Sheamus versus Orton, which, by the way, Michael Cole made this announcement in the most confusing manner possible.
I had no idea what was going on.
They
announced a three-way, and they announced four guys, and I'm going like, how's four guys a three-way? And then it was kind of explained that Punk and Barrett both weren't going to be in it.
Yeah, Barrett said that he would take the match, and Punk said, fine, you can take it. And he said he didn't want to fight, he wanted to talk, and he said if Barrett won, he would join the Nexus and work for Barrett, this being Punk. But if Barrett lost the match, he was out of Nexus. So that was a big stipulation, which Wade begrudgingly agreed to. So there you go. We had Alberto Del Rio doing a promo talking about how he was going to become the champion. He was going to win the Rumble. He was going to go to Main Event Mania. Truth cut him off. They had a match. I didn't think Del Rio was very good in this match. I thought his selling was awful. I thought he was off on a lot of stuff. I don't know if it was just he's normally post-produced on SmackDown or if he just had a bad day here. But
And probably also never worked with Truth before.
That's probably another thing. But not a blowaway match here by any means. He won with the armbar.
I would agree with you because watching it technically, I thought he didn't look good. But I also thought that from a personality standpoint, I think that I'm just thinking that he still kind of got his personality got over pretty good.
Well, sure, yeah. And he's got a new deal that he does as well where he does the smile, but when you make him mad, he mutters angrily to himself and to his opponent, and you can't hear what he says, and he does it very, very well. Significantly better than I'm explaining it here, but I thought that was a good little addition to the character there because you saw some of the fire in Alberto Del Rio that I guess presumably we'll see when he's a babyface someday.
You know, I mean, not that this is any great revelation, but that ring announcer's great.
Oh, God, yeah. He's the best ring announer they've got. Really, he
awesome.
Is. Yeah, there's nobody in WWE that's as good as he is, but, I mean, not even close. Well, yeah. Finkel, but he's not doing it. But we had Barrett meeting with Nexus, and it was one of those meetings where everybody was facing the camera looking awkward. Otunga spoke way too much, which was almost not at all, but it was still too much. And basically, they telegraphed what was going to happen when Punk shook everyone's hand after Wade left. And
they were going to stab Wade in the back. But you know what's funny is you know, as we get to the thing, I thought that it would be, you know, all of Nexus in there at the end, and it was only Punk.
That's what I thought, too, based on the way that Otunga basically said, yeah, Wade, when Wade said, when they all said that they were going to support him. So we had Orton and Baron Sheamus in a cage match. It's pretty good. The crowd was really into it. I will say that Orton is used to working a very methodical, slow-paced match, and he was in with two guys that don't really work a methodical, slow-paced match, so I think he got tired because he started moving real slow there at the end and then did a lot of laying down. But the finish...
Well, you gotta also remember, he's still hurt.
Yeah, that too. Well, I mean, I think he's still a smoker, and I don't know. I don't see him being a cardio machine. And when
he's got the body where he should be a cardio machine.
Well, he's
I don't know that he is.
Yeah, I don't know. I just know that he does not work like a guy who's a cardio machine. And I think when he's in there with guys that are going to push the pace, it could get rough for him.
Yeah.
But he ended up down, and Sheamus booted Wade, demanded they open the door. Actually, there was some stuff that took place before that was kind of important. That being that Barrett went to escape, and Punk came down to help him. But as he reached to help pull him out, instead he grabbed the Nexus armband and then booted Barrett back into the cage. And that actually got a pop. I don't know what reaction they were expecting, but it got a cheer. And then Sheamus booted Wade. Orton gave the RKO to Sheamus. And it was funny because, like, if it were anyone else, well, I shouldn't say anyone else, but most stupid guys would do the spot where, oh, I'm about to go out the door, but I'm going to climb to the top and do something really stupid off the cage and almost kill myself. Not Orton, he just walked out. And everybody cheered really big, and I thought, well, you know, That's a smart guy right there. So he won. He's going on.
One of that that was weird is when Orton and Sheamus were both laid out, Barrett could have walked out the door, but instead he climbed the cage, which of course he had to for the storyline, but it just made no sense.
Yeah. Well,
especially considering that he was selling his arm, and that he, you know, the whole issue of why Punk was there was because he couldn't climb with one arm, so Punk lent him a hand like he was going to help pull him over, and then, of course, turned on him at the top.
Maybe they just felt that they didn't want to slam the damn cage door on someone's head again.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably better than doing it that way, because that's become a cliche anyway.
So it is Orton and Miz at the pay-per-view. Morrison and Lawler out to dry. They may do the four-way next week or some point soon. I was told it would be on TV. Could have changed their minds, though, so we'll find out. But based on storylines, I think that it only makes sense that Lawler should at least get a shot or at least another match based on being...
Yeah, absolutely. Especially he should be going for revenge.
According to him.
And a championship match since he won the non-title.
That's right. And according to him, he's 2-0.
Yeah, well, just forget the match that was the most important of all of them.
Fedor is returning to the ring to face Brett Rogers.
No? Bigfoot Silva.
Oh, Bigfoot Silva. I'm sorry. What am I talking about? Brett Rogers has another
match. Brett Rogers and Fedor was last year.
That's right. He's returning at the Meadowlands. He's going to be facing Bigfoot Silva. And
It's not, the contracts are not signed, as best I can tell, but it's definitely a deal that has been talked about and that the presumption is will happen. But, you know, I mean, again, until the contracts are signed, it's a rough deal. But, yeah, February 12th at the Izod Center, the Meadowlands in East Rutherford, New Jersey, the M1 people want Fedor fighting in the New York market badly. And I think it's Strikeforce's first time in that market.
I got to say this. I would like Strikeforce to succeed, just like I would really like TNA to succeed, just not with the current product. But the idea of running a tournament over the course of the year with Fedor and Alistair Overeem involved. I mean, you know what I mean? You're begging for this to fall apart.
Alistair Overeem is not really a problem. Now, with Fedor, you know, because of his management, of course, it's a potential disaster because they're going to want to renegotiate or pull him out or he's going to break his finger or, you know, the idea that...
Yeah, but hold on.
If he doesn't lose, you know, that and, you know, the whole thing is built for... You know, the whole way the tournament is built is to get to Fedor and Alistair Overeem on pay-per-view in September or October or whenever they want to do this. That's the idea. And to count on, you know, that all running smooth is, you know, you're asking a lot.
Overeem, I mean, maybe you're right, but he has had one fight in Strikeforce in 2011, so it's almost 4 years now.
Yeah, he said one fight in almost 4 years. Yeah, but that's because, you know, for a couple of years they didn't want to use him. They never even contacted him. So, you know, he was their champion, but they never used him. And then, you know, he did get into that fight in the nightclub and broke his hand or whatever it was, got the infection. So that kept him out for a while. But, you know, the whole thing like this year is, he was going to do, after the big hit he was at last year's K1 Grand Prix, they wanted him for this year's. So, the fact that he was doing the K1 on the New Year's Eve, you know, that's been known for a long time that he wasn't going to be available now. So, you know, now this, you know, at this point, he's available, you know, and at the end of the year, if K1 is still around and there's a K1 Grand Prix, obviously he's going to go back to defend his championship. So, you know, from September on, he's not going to be available. So they've got their, you know, it's kind of like they've got their season right now. But it's a tough one because... You know, when you're relying on people who have contracts with other groups in a tournament, it's tough.
Let's jump into the mailbag here. We've got a lot of questions. Haven't got a chance to get to a lot of these of late. This person says, and I don't really think there's an answer, but we'll ask it. What is the significance or purpose for a wrestler to wear a one-strap singlet as opposed to two straps, and why does Jerry Lawler wear one? Just the style. With Lawler, you have to have one to pull down. And I think Andre, he may have just looked more like some sort of beast with, I don't know, Tarzan-type singlet.
Yeah, I have no, you know, people's choice on what they want to wear.
I was watching the first In Your House on 24/7, this person says. It featured the short-lived Stephanie Wyant, who I remember from Mania with Todd Pettengill. Who was she? What was her background? What is she up to now? And did the WWE feel like they needed to have someone represent the minivan soccer moms?
Didn't she do didn't she do a reality show? No, it was Rebecca Budig that just did the ice skating show. And she was a host of, I think, Heat.
Let's see if Stephanie anything comes Wyant. Up when I Google her.
What?
I'll Google her.
She did something fairly significant. Maybe she was on a soap opera or something.
Hmm.
You can Google her. Yeah, check. I know she did something in the last couple of years, though.
Nothing's coming up immediately here except a bunch of LinkedIn stuff, so I'll look around. But the next question here, this is TNA. If they only tape 4 days a month and have one pay-per-view, what do the non-stars do the rest of the month? For example, Beer Money, Jay Lethal, Motor City Machine Guns, do they have side jobs?
They don't have side jobs, most of them, but they a lot of them work indies, and a lot of them have time off.
And I mean, obviously, the December was different, but for January, I mean, they've got several house shows over the next couple
of weeks. Yeah. Actually, TNA is running a lot more extensive house show schedule the last year than they ever have in the past, and they'll probably continue that this year because they make money on the house shows because they do such good merchandise business.
All right. This person here says... talking about TNA on Bravo, we don't have an answer yet.
Yeah, still no answer.
They said later in January they would announce what the idea was for where it was going to end up, Impact.
You would think they would have had their act together by now, given that sale, or that closing down of Bravo was months ago. They would have figured out what they were doing, like, months ago.
This person says, why don't wrestlers have equal salaries, whether they're champion or not? To me, they're
not. Because some draw more than others.
Well, he says, they're not competing against each other to see who the best is. The matches are rigged. You can also rise at the top by the help of your colleagues. Realistically, you shouldn't earn more money just because you're the champion. Wouldn't it be more fair if
Well, you don't necessarily earn more money. Holding the championship doesn't mean you earn more money.
But Miz is making less money than Orton, for example.
What?
Miz is making less money than Orton, for example.
Yeah, or than Cena.
Exactly.
And Cena's not really going to make more as champion, or whether he's champion or not. He's going to make main event money either way, and merchandise money either way.
And he says, wouldn't it be more fair if everyone had a base salary and they earned additional money off of their face heel popularity? Well, it's basically what happens.
Except everyone's base is different.
Yes. And really, this is an argument that people have made in the past, and it is valid. I mean, yes, it is fake. And when you win a championship, you are not really the best grappler in the company, although you may be. But
in the old days, you sort of...
In the old days, you were. But, I mean, nowadays...
It's not like you were, but you were...
They felt you would take care of yourself.
They felt that you just... If you won the championship, they felt it was because you being champion would draw more money for the company.
Well, yeah, and to a degree...
If they didn't think that you could draw money... They wouldn't bother giving you a championship.
Yes, but even today, I mean, if you're a long-term champion, I mean, it is as many wrestlers have stated, and this is for the main championship. I'm not talking about the damn women's title that these girls freak out about, but like the main title in the company. I mean, they are expecting a lot out of you, and you have proven something to them in order for them to give you this for an extended period of time.
To a degree, I mean, they gave it to Swagger though.
Yeah, but it wasn't like he was considered like the centerpiece guy for the company.
No.
He was the guy on SmackDown for the time.
Well, it was that he won Money in the Bank because they got mad at Drew, and once he won, they feel that every winner of Money in the Bank has to get the title, so he had to get the title.
But for example, Miz, I mean, if the original plan for Miz was a month, and Miz, through all of the stuff that he's done with the media and everything else, has really impressed them as somebody that is actually doing something for the company, he could get that reign extended. He's meant something to them.
Yeah. Yeah, he's done a good job.
Let's do a couple more here. I believe it was Terry Funk who said something in the effect of, if you want to see what the U.S. wrestling scene is going to be like in 10 years, look at Japan. Do you think the same theory applies to MMA as well? Is the lessening interest in the Dynamite show an indication of what could happen here in the future?
That's amazing, because I wrote that almost that word for word about 2 days ago. I don't know, because it's MMA in Japan and MMA in the United States are so completely different, but then again, so are professional wrestling. And it's funny, because the MMA in Japan is closer to American professional wrestling, And the professional wrestling in Japan, when it was popular, is actually closer to American MMA. I don't know why that is, but it is what it is. I don't know, you know, again, every sport like that is going to have its ups and downs. And just because you say, well, it's a sport, it does. You know, I mean, there have been sports that were really popular on television 10, 20 years ago that aren't anymore in the United States. Everything, you know, I mean, soccer's had its ups and downs, and figure skating's had its ups and downs, and, you know, hockey's had its ups and downs, and golf's had its ups and downs. And, you know, usually the ups come when you've got a larger-than-life star or stars carrying it, like the NBA. You know, I mean, NBA, boxing, they're all carried by stars. And UFC, UFC's popularity will always be star-driven. That's going to be the key to it. And if there comes a period where there are not stars, it's going to hurt. You know, then you got to make new stars. The problem with Japan, there's two problems with Japan. Number one is that it's the whole tide of everything in Japan when it comes to those kind of sports is down. So you're bucking a tide. You'd be bucking a tide even if you were doing everything right and you created new stars. But it's amplified by the fact that the entire Japanese MMA business was built on a certain thing, which was Sakuraba beating the Gracies, and Sakuraba being a national hero, and his run was over, and they had to have some guys replace him, and they kind of did with Akiyama and Yamamoto, but it just didn't, you know, it didn't work out in the sense that, you know, Akiyama didn't work out, and Yamamoto got hurt and then wasn't a world beater, and you know, so there's a lot of things. But I mean, the idea that because UFC is so big now that they're free and clear and they're never going to have any problems and you don't have to worry about their business going up or down is ludicrous, because we've seen this with, you know, I mean, anyone who lived through WCW, you know, should realize, you know, how hot WCW was, and 18 months later they were dead. And granted, it took incredible amounts of stupidity, levels of stupidity unforeseen for it to happen that quick. But it can happen. And again, if UFC has a run of absolute stupidity, which I would bet against, then they could put themselves in, you know, that, you know, like that. I mean, I don't expect that to happen. But if they have injuries to top stars, or they come through a period where, you know, they don't have the star power and everything like that, I mean, it ain't going to be like last year. Last year was a you had three really huge drawing cards all at the same time who were fighting regularly, and you know, and Lesnar St. Pierre and BJ Penn, and even, you know, Liddell's final match and things like that. And they had two incredible grudge matches. One absolutely incredible in Evans and Jackson build up, not necessarily the match, and then the other with St. Pierre and Koscheck, and you had Chael Sonnen coming out of nowhere and drawing a buy rate in a show that was expected to bomb. So, you know, you had a lot of good luck in the last year. Some years you're going to have a lot of bad luck. You're going to have a lot of injuries. You know, and you're not always, you know, some years you're going to have Frankie Edgar as lightweight champion and not BJ Penn. And then these all are factors in what's going to happen. It's hard to predict the future, but Japan, I mean, Japan was so personality-driven, and then they just didn't have the right personalities. I mean, these guys, like Takaya, you know, I will look at him, and he just, you know, he's never going to be a superstar in Japan, whether he wins all his fights or not. In the United States, you know, I mean, I guess you could say the same, but you know what? If Edgar keeps winning for a year, Edgar is going to end up being a superstar. He really will, just by the virtue of continually winning. But, you know, it may take a while.
Say 2 years. I don't know about a year. I'll say in 2 years, if he's still winning, he'll be a superstar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Anderson Silva became a superstar.
Sure.
You know, I mean, and can draw with the right opponent. Frankie, you know, and the thing is with the lightweight division, there's a lot of charismatic guys in that division.
Yeah, but Silva could also go out there and slaughter a man in a minute, whereas Edgar, when you have 8 decisions in 10 fights, it's going to take you a little bit longer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's got to get over in a different way. And, I mean, he, you know, got to give him all the credit in the world. I think him and Maynard both helped themselves on Saturday. But I also think that they've both got, you know. I mean, like the rematch, I think will do slightly better than the first match, but it ain't going to do. I don't see it knocking anyone dead either.
No. We are out of time, everybody, but we're going to be back on Wednesday with a brand new show. We've also got a bunch of newsletters going up. We have a back issue of The Observer going up. We've got a brand new issue of Figure Four Weekly, which will be up tomorrow afternoon. New issue of The Observer out on Wednesday, and a bunch of radio shows as well. Kevin Kelly from ROH, formerly WWE, is going to be on the show tomorrow. And, of course, Todd Martin's going to be on the show on, I believe, Thursday. Dr. Lucha and Chris Zellner talking Lucha on Wednesday. So a lot of stuff coming up. Check out the front page, and we'll talk to you again after a while.